Get started. The story of Judah and Tamar, it's one of the strangest things about in the Torah that this suddenly interrupts the story of Joseph. And we've been going along, remember, learning about Joseph and how his brother sold him into slavery, and we stopped at the moment that he's about to get to Egypt, right? He hasn't gotten to Egypt yet. He's been picked up by caravans of Midianites and Ishmaelites, not clear who picked him up when. And he's on his way to Egypt in order to fulfill the destiny of Israel, although nobody knows that yet. And then all of a sudden, the Torah stops in the middle and tells a completely different story. Why the story is in there is something we're going to come back to, but first let's, probably not today, but first let's understand the story as it is, and along the way at least we'll pick up some clues about why it's there. Okay? So chapter 38. Okay, about that time. Now, about that time, Vihi ba'etahi, that's clearly intended to serve as a sort of land bridge from the previous story, right? And it's almost the way of acknowledging this has nothing to do with that, but it happened around the same time, so we think we'll talk about it. It can't be at the same time, because where is Judah during the sale of Joseph? He's with all the brothers, right? So it either happened right before, right after, not clear, but around that time. He left his brothers and camped near a certain Adullamite whose name was Hirah. Now, it doesn't seem to, by the way, left is literally, he went down from his brothers. It doesn't say he left. It says vayored, and yirida is physical and spiritual, right? He's about to, I mean, first of all, he did not distinguish himself in the sale of Joseph. He didn't save Joseph when he might have been able to, although maybe he was instrumental in their not killing him. But nonetheless, as somebody who's a leader among his brothers, he didn't save Joseph. And so the went down is supposed to be, according to the rabbis, an indication that his descent is continuing, right? He descended with the brothers, and now it's about to get worse, because what Judah's going to do is not going to be praiseworthy in the minds of the rabbis, or for that matter of the Bible, as you'll see. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and cohabited with her. Now, again, already, not, you know, what you want your son to do, but it is also true that there weren't a lot of Israelites around, although remember that Isaac and Jacob managed to marry within the family. So there was enough family for people to find. Judah doesn't do that. He finds a Canaanite, and we all know how the Bible feels about Canaanites. However, in the end, of course, Judah is the line of the Messiah. And this is one more instance of the idea that is going to be really reinforced by this story, that the Messiah comes from a line that's not a pure, undistinguished line, that in fact God can configure the Messiah from anyone God chooses. However, still, that may be part of the Yerida, that may be part of the descent. Okay, she conceives and bears a son and named him Er. Er means awakening. Why the first son is named Er is going to be an interesting question, but he's not going to have a happy fate. She conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. Once again, she bore a son and named him Shelah. She was at Chaziv when she bore him. Why that's mentioned is not entirely clear, but let's, as I say, we're going to look at more care through several parts of the story in the week to come, but let's at least get through the essence of it. Judah got a wife for Er, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. Now, interestingly, it doesn't say where she comes from, but this name only appears in the Davidic family, so maybe she's family. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was displeasing to the Lord, and the Lord took his life. So, this is obviously problematic. We don't know what he did, although we will be able to guess retrospectively what he did. And notice the juxtaposition, the way the two are put together. He gets married, he dies. Okay? Yes, exactly so. Well, and this motif, by the way, of the deadly woman or the deadly wife is not an uncommon motif in folk tales. So just keep that in mind, okay? Then Judah said to Onan, join with your brother's wife and do your duty by her as a brother-in-law and provide offspring for your brother. Now, this is not exactly, this develops into Levirate marriage. The idea is remember that the property is divided between the three of them, okay? The firstborn gets the most. So the firstborn, let's say, gets 50%. I don't know if this is the exact percentages. The other two get 25. Now, if this happens each generation, then what's going to happen is, of course, that the properties eventually, you're going to own this much land, right? That's why the firstborn gets a lot more, with the idea of keeping the family inheritance together. Otherwise, you're going to have one of those situations where, I don't know if you ever saw Woody Allen's movie Love and Death. It's a satire on Russian novels, and he says, you know, I love my plot of land, and it's meant so much to me. He takes out this little clump of dirt from his, this is my plot of land, right? And that's what you would get in the end. So the firstborn has the largest holding. Now, what if he dies without any children? The second brother is supposed to have a child with his wife that will inherit his property. So it's not the second brother's child, really. It's really the first brother's child, which gives rise to the whole question of the Book of Ruth. We're going to put that aside, but that's where you may know this from. So in other words, it's Onan's responsibility to have a child with Tamar that will be heir's child and will be heir to heir. Okay? Good. So, all right. Onan, knowing that the seed would not count as his, right? It's not going to be his child. Let it go to waste whenever he joined with his brother's wife so as not to provide offspring for his brother. What he did was displeasing to the Lord, and he took his life also. Okay? God is on a rampage. So let's first of all, this, we're all adults here, right? This is going to be an X-rated class. Let's first talk about Onan, because Onan obviously is important in history. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Mel Brooks' 2013-year-old man, but if you're not, it's hilariously funny. And he plays a 2013-year-old man, someone who goes back in history. And he, of course, has a Yiddish accent. And Carl Reiner interviews him. And he's talking about great discoveries in history. And he talks about this person, that person. Then he says, and Onan. And Reiner says, Onan, what did he discover? He says, Onan discovered himself. He says, he fell down and grabbed onto himself, and that's how he fell in love. And he says, but God didn't like it because you're supposed to be fruitful and multiply, and Onan was fruitless and subtracted. But what Brooks is making fun of is, of course, the fact that in history, Onan is identified with masturbation. Onanism in English is another word for masturbation. Now, you can see in the Torah that it's actually not about masturbation. Clearly, right? It's about coitus interruptus, which is a fancy Latin way of saying he didn't come inside of her. Instead, he withdrew at the last minute so his ejaculate would be spilled and so that she wouldn't have a child, right? And that's what's that? TMI. What does that stand for?
Too much information.
Too much information, right. You know, when you're studying the Torah, but you need to know what it is that he did, because you have to understand why God punishes him. God punishes him because he doesn't fulfill the mitzvah, not because he masturbates, right? That's not the punishment. The punishment is that he interrupts intercourse with her because he's supposed to have a child with her. But this verse has caused untold misery, right, throughout history. And even today, by the way, in traditional Jewish circles, they will tell you that masturbation is against Jewish law. And it's based on this, which, again, this may fall under the same abbreviation that Sean just mentioned, but I remember when I was a kid, we had this ridiculous class in Akiba Academy in Philadelphia. Instead of calling it sex education, they called it issues of adolescence, right? IA was what it was called. And God bless her, the woman who taught it was probably, I mean, at the time she was an adult, but she was probably very young. I think she was in her early 20s. She didn't know how to teach this to eighth graders. If anyone does, or eighth or ninth grade. But she was talking about how oppressive religious attitudes were towards sexuality and so on, because she was going to liberate all of us. There were a lot of things I could tell you about that class, but I will restrict it to something that's worth mentioning. She turned to me in the middle of the class, and everyone knew that I was the rabbi's kid because the lower school of Akiba was housed in my father's synagogue. This was now the upper school. Now it's not, it's all in one building, but so everyone, and she said, why don't you ask your father when, if ever, it's okay to masturbate? So yeah, exactly. Not a real good teacher move, but I felt like I took my homework seriously. So I went home and I said to my father, my teacher told me to ask you when it's okay to masturbate. And he said, it's okay unless you prefer it to sex with someone you love. Which I thought was actually the best answer conceivable. No pun intended. Yes, very wise father. And I went back, I was so proud to, But that obviously is not the answer traditionally that Judaism gave. And it all comes from this verse, right? This is the verse that, but you see in the context of the story, that has nothing to do with it. It has to do entirely with Onan not fulfilling his legal obligation to his dead brother, okay? But now let's assume you're Judah. You gave your first son, heir, to this woman. Almost immediately, he dies. You give your second son to this woman, and he dies. Now, granted that doesn't prove that she's a dangerous woman, right? And we know that in both cases, the Torah doesn't blame her. But you can understand why Judah is reluctant to give his third son to this woman, but that is his legal obligation according to Jewish law, because she still hasn't had her kid, his kid, Er's kid, Onan's kid, somebody's kid. So what Judah is supposed to do now is say, this is terrible, but obviously not your fault, and here's Shelah. But he doesn't do that. Okay, so let's take a look. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, stay as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. For he thought he too might die like his brothers, so Tamar went to live in her father's house. A long time afterwards, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. Now his wife has died, okay? And it says a long time afterwards to indicate that he never went back to Tamar and said, here's my grown son, and she's in her father's house, basically a childless widow, twice with no future, right? Because no one else is going to marry her because she's part of Judah's family, and if Shelah doesn't marry her, he's effectively chained her forever. When his period of mourning was over, Judah went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers together with his friend Hira the Adullamite. Remember, we got Hira from before. And Tamar was told, your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah for the sheep shearing. Say that five times real fast. So she took off, her widow's garb, okay, covered her face with a veil, and wrapping herself up, sat down at the entrance to Enayim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she'd not been given to him as a wife. So she now understands that she's never going to get Shelah, and she hatches a scheme. When Judah saw her, he took her for a harlot, for she had covered her face. Right? He thought she was a prostitute because her face was covered and she was sitting at the entrance of the city and she was a single woman. And it was apparently not at all uncommon. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, here, let me sleep with you, for he didn't know she was his daughter-in-law. Again, a very not uncommon motif of you don't know who it is and then there's a moment of revelation. What she asked, will you pay me for sleeping with me? He replied, I'll send you a kid from my flock. Right, which, by the way, is like, I'll pay you afterwards, which she would be foolish to believe because then he goes back to his flock and what if he never sends a kid just because he said, I'm going to pay you? It's like, I'll pay you next Tuesday. But she's a prostitute and he's a respected citizen and he's going to say he never slept with her. There are all sorts of, she would be foolish. She said, you must leave a pledge until you've sent it. Now, why is she doing this? Because she wants to be able to prove that she slept with him. And he said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your seal and cord and the staff which you carry. which Alter, and I'm going to talk about his analysis of this next week, said is equivalent to all your major credit cards, right? It's not just your seal. It's your seal and your cord and your staff that you carry, which is everything that basically identifies him as Judah, because that's how you get identified. So she's A, ensuring that he will come back to her, and B, ensuring that she can prove that she slept with Judah, because otherwise she would never have all those things. So he gave them to her and slept with her, right? And she conceived by him. Then she went on her way. She took off her veil and again put on her widow's garb. Judah sent the kid by his friend the Adullamite to redeem the pledge from the woman, but he couldn't find her. He inquired of the people of that town, where is the cult prostitute, the one at Enaim by the road? But they said, there's been no prostitute here. So he returned to Judah and said, I couldn't find her. Moreover, the townspeople said, there's been no prostitute here. Judah said, let her keep them, lest we become a laughingstock. I did send her this kid, but you didn't find her. He's saying, look, I can't go around the town and ask every stray woman, do you have my seal? So let her keep it. You know, I'll buy a new seal. And about 3 months later, a long time afterwards, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law has played the harlot. In fact, she is with child by harlotry. Because now, it has to be that she prostituted herself because she's not married. She has a kid. And everyone knows she's not married, which means, of course, also, you see it's not even a double standard. It's like a quadruple standard. Nobody says to him, what do you mean you slept with a prostitute? They all say, oh, it's a shame you can't find her to pay her. But, of course, she is liable to horrific punishment, even death. Bring her out, said Judah, and let her be burned. Okay? And this, for most of the rabbis, is the culmination of his Yeridah. It's like he's gradually gone down and down and down. Not only does he not save his brother, not only does he not give her his third child, not only does he sleep with a prostitute, but then he wants to condemn another prostitute to death, having slept with a prostitute himself, right? So he's gone completely low, and now you have to look for his redemption. As she was being brought out, she sent this message to her father-in-law. I am with child by the man to whom these belong. And she added, examine these, whose seal and cord and staff are these? Now, this is, again, in the process of looking at the story, it's important to realize she just took a great risk. She sent him everything. She didn't keep anything back, which means that she believes in his essential decency, because he could take all of them and say, how did you get my stuff? Or I visited you in your father's house. I mean, she's family. Judah recognized them and said, she is more in the right than I. Now, notice why he says this, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he was not intimate with her again. So this is Judah's redemption, because, again, the assumption is he doesn't have to admit. He's a person of position and power and authority, and she's a husbandless, pregnant woman. But this is the beginning of Judah's redemption, which, of course, will culminate in the episode with Joseph when he comes to see Joseph later. But the reason why it's important is because of what follows. When time came for her to give birth, there were twins in her womb. While she was in labor, one of them put out his hand, and the midwife tied a crimson thread on that hand to signify this one came out first. Okay? But just then he drew back his hand, and out came out his brother, and she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Peretz. Afterward, his brother came out, on whose hand was the crimson thread, and he was named Zerach. Okay? So now, what happens with Peretz? Anyone know? Norm knows. Tell us.
Eventually, he is from the line of David.
That's right. Yeah. Peretz, in other words, Peretz is the precursor of the Messiah. Mm-hmm. Okay? From Peretz comes the line of David, which means that, I mean, we know that David is the king of Judah, right? From Judah's line and Peretz, which means that from incest, basically, because that's what this is, essentially, it's very close. I mean, it's his son's wife, comes the Messiah. And also from Ruth comes the Messiah. So it's at least adultery, right? And from a Moabite, In other words, the line of the Messiah is not a pure Israelite, uncomplicated line, quite the opposite, which is a very interesting thing we can talk about later, but I just want to point out that part of the reason this story is told is because Peretz becomes very important as an ancestor. All right, now, as I said, we're going to do more detailed analysis of some of the terms in the story and so on, and why it is that this is stuck in the middle of the story of Joseph. But a lot of the themes that we've already seen are here. First of all, again, as with almost every family in Genesis, this family is completely messed up, right? I mean, we don't have so far a successful family by almost any reckoning. Second, Judah has just deprived his father of his child and immediately afterwards learns what it is to lose a child, right? He just deprived him of Joseph, after all. But he doesn't know what it is to lose a child, because how can you possibly know what it is to lose a child if you haven't lost a child? Now he understands what he did to his father, right? Because it's clear that their emotional center in the story is getting rid of Joseph and not how's our father going to react. If their central concern was how's our father going to react, they would have said, look, we hate Joseph, but we can't do anything with him because we love our father too much. But their hatred of Joseph was greater than their love of their father. This now changes that for Judah because he's changed his generational focus. Before, it was all about being a son. Now it's all about being a father. So now he understands what he did, which is probably why he has this compassion towards Tamar. You know that in the Jewish tradition, you can't sit as a judge on a capital case, a case that might involve the death penalty, unless you have children. A childless rabbi can't sit on a capital case. And the reason that that's so is that you can't know what human life is worth to someone. You can't appreciate the fact that this is someone's child if you don't have a child. So for Judah, this is a very powerful learning experience. And it also recaps this theme of parents and children and the way in which children sacrifice parents and parents sacrifice children throughout the book of Genesis in particular, although not only in Genesis, also throughout the Bible. And next is that this enables us to see Judah as an independent actor, which we haven't seen very much of so far, but we'll see much later when we get to Egypt and he has to redeem Joseph. And then finally, it allows us to see something that we also haven't seen very much, which is a woman as an independent actor, right? She is at first acted upon, which is what usually happens in the Bible to women, with a couple of notable exceptions. And really, her options are extremely limited, if you think about it. What can she possibly do as a single woman, as a widow with no children? But she conceives a scheme that works, right? So all of this, again, it combines lots and lots of different themes that we will elaborate on when we examine the story in more detail. And when you ask yourself why it's dropped here in the middle, the one thing that's clear from the start is that the idea of the story of Joseph makes the brothers into a group of people. They're almost extras in the story. They act as one. And the intent here, in part, is, I think, to remind us that each of them actually are individuals and have their own stories, even though not all of their stories are going to be told in the course of the Torah. And then lastly, of course, there's a question of God and why God does what God does. And here, as the only thing that we can really say about it is that clearly a certain God is, again, looking to a certain end, which is the precursor of the Messiah, and that human beings in one way or another cooperate in that end. That is, Er and Onan do something to get themselves out of the way, and in the end, God, or you can say, originally God would have liked for Er to be the precursor of the Messiah, but he had to make do with this very messy way because that's what human beings are, so God will take this illicit liaison and make that the precursor of the Messiah, because one way or another that's going to happen. Okay, let me stop there and take questions or comments. Go ahead.
Tamar knew that Judah was her father-in-law when she slept with him.
Yes. Yeah. Not only did she know, that's exactly what she intended. Right.
Do Perez and Zerah become the heirs of Er?
Yes, they would.
And which one?
They would. The oldest. Always the oldest.
The older.
The one with the red thread, Zerah. The one, it's the younger son who becomes a precursor of the Messiah, which, by the way, is also, as we know this in the Bible, it's always the younger son, right, who does well. There are innumerable examples, Isaac, Jacob, Moses. It's always the younger son who does better. And the reason that that's so in the Bible is because it upends the convention of the time, which is that the older son is always the one that matters. And the point is that God can make the younger son matter, and this is a perfect example, right? The whole point, what's the point of the red thread? In part, the point of the red thread is to let you know that it was specifically the younger who proved to be, and he is the one, remember that his name means breach, because he came out ahead even though he was the younger, just like Israel will come out ahead even though in the time of the Bible it's the younger people, right? So.
As a matter of record, on page 480 of Boy Scout Handbook, in 1944, there was one paragraph entitled Preservation, and we were told without its name, it was bad.
And you told what?
We were told without its name, it was bad.
Wow.
That was the entire phrase of masturbation.
Oh, of masturbation. Got it.
We were in the Boy Scouts.
That it was bad.
Bad. Yeah. And it was under a paragraph headed Preservation.
Preservation. Well, there were a lot of myths about masturbation throughout history, that it was bad, right? That it would grow hair, that it would give you bad skin, which all of which, you know, I mean, these are all things that coincide with adolescence. So it made sense, right?
This is how guys like me.
Yes.
How we were
right. Yes. Everybody was raised that way until the last 30, 40 years. I will take it anyway. A non-masturbation question from the back. Yes.
Justice system, the amazing rule that you mentioned about the juror having children.
Yes.
Is it honored by the lawyer that the...
It's honored in the rabbinical courts. It's honored in rabbinical courts. This is a law in Jewish law. So, but there are no rabbinical courts.
Is it honored in our legal system?
No.
By the lawyers that interview...
No. No, because it's not an American law. It's in Jewish law. And our legal system is not according to Jewish law. So it's not honored. It was only honored when there were rabbinical courts that could make life and death decisions. But it is a great rule, but that hasn't been for a long time. So, and I don't think you could make such a rule in America. So, yeah.
To play devil's advocate on behalf of Judah for a moment.
Sure.
In today's Israeli army, if children go to the army and one child dies, doesn't the family have the option of not sending the other child to the army?
Yes, but it's not quite the same, I don't think. I mean, I understand what you're saying.
So,
yeah.
The
issue with Judah was that he blamed her for what his sons did. If she killed them, he'd be right. But she didn't kill them. In fact, it was his own son's refusal to honor his dead brother that killed the second son. So it's clear, that's why it says Er did something that was displeasing to the Lord, because it wants to make it clear to you that this isn't Tamar's fault. Look, when I talk to couples and they have problems with their in-laws, and then I talk to the in-laws, all the time it's very confusing, right? There are such different perceptions of what it is that the daughter-in-law did that the mother-in-law objects to. Mm-hmm. But occasionally it's pretty clear. Occasionally it's clear that one or the other is really just either exercising control unreasonably or being unkind unreasonably, because it's about a power struggle. Mm-hmm. And here, the Torah makes it crystal clear that it was Judah's son's fault, and Judah took revenge on her. So I think that's why he says, you're more right than I. Even then, well, what he says is tzid kami meni, which could just be you're right and I'm wrong also.
Yeah. And is the assumption then, based on it says, if he died also, that the first thing, it was going back to Onan, mm-hmm. if he died, he took his life also.
Yeah.
Is the assumption then that Er was also wasted his seed?
Some, right. There are some commentators that say exactly that.
Yeah,
does it say that she, right, since he died also, because of the also, that it's the same thing? I think Rashi says that.
They said she was a beautiful woman. They didn't.
Right. Oh, that was the other, right. That didn't want to, I remember that midrash. They didn't want to disfigure her by pregnancy. That's why they wouldn't have children with her. That was right. That's what the midrash says. And therefore they withdrew. Because remember, this was to some extent an age without birth control, although not entirely, because we know, for example, that already in ancient times people would use peach pits with camels to ensure the camels wouldn't get pregnant on long journeys, right? So the idea of some kind of barrier that would prevent pregnancy was not unknown, but I don't know that there was any really effective birth control in the ancient world. And so So the midrash was, why wouldn't they have a child with her? That's what they were trying to wonder. I mean, the Torah gives its own reason. He didn't want it to be his brother's kid, but the midrash comes up with another reason. He wanted her to remain beautiful. Yeah. It's whoever comes out first gets counted as the firstborn. That's what as opposed to who's born. I guess so. I mean, why not? No. Yeah, just a limb.
Doesn't have to be the case.
And the other question is, Onan, did he have wife or wives, children at that time? Did that have mattered?
No. I mean, it might have mattered. Well, I shouldn't say that. He could have, yeah. He could have had a wife, he could have had children, and it wouldn't have mattered anyway. Whether he had a wife or he didn't have a wife, he still has this obligation. Yes, he still has this obligation.
So we don't even know.
No. There's a wonderful movie about this, by the way. What's it called? I Love You, Rosa? Is that what it's called? A great Israeli movie about the wife of an older brother dies, and there's a younger brother. I saw it many years ago. I don't really remember it. As a younger brother, it's in Israel, who's supposed to fulfill this obligation, but he's a kid. It's I remember it being a very powerful and tender movie. Anyway, so. It stopped basically by the time of the rabbis. There was already a ceremony by which you could, which is what you see in I Love You, Rosa, by which you could get out of the obligation. And by then, it was more or less standard that everyone did. So, yeah. Are you holding your arm up for the sun or for? You're welcome to move if you're in the sun. Just move to somewhere. There are all these seats over here that don't. Go ahead. Okay. Well, it just seems from the context that we don't know that it's contraception because what it says explicitly is that he let it go to waste, which whenever he joined with her, which means that he had. So, oh, you're asking me, did it only because we don't know of any sort of contraception? So, I mean, in theory, it could have been, but I don't even know what that would be. So, no, I mean. Right. So this is, it depends who you're asking. If you're asking the question of where the laws came from before the Torah was written, this is much discussed in Jewish sources, as you can imagine. If you're asking someone traditionally, then they would say that, you know, God revealed some of the laws before the Torah was written. So that's why Abraham was still understood the laws of Kashrut. And these, a less traditional-minded rabbi or scholar, what they'll tell you is that many of the laws of the Torah enshrined laws that already existed in the community. This is how people conducted their lives. And then when the laws got written down, because most law for most of history was oral, right? At a certain point, it gets written down. But usually it gets written down because of catastrophe or a fear that it's going to be lost. Or so. And in fact, there was a great prejudice in the Jewish tradition, as in other oral traditions, against writing things down, because an oral teaching is so much more alive and so much more flexible and so much more embodied in a person than a book. And someone who sits with a book, it's not like, in fact, this is Chaim Soloveitchik, who is a historian, wrote a very famous article I think he wrote it in Tradition, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, a little bit more. He's a part of the Soloveitchik family, so part of a very eminent Orthodox family. He's a profound scholar of especially medieval times, but not only medieval times. Sefer Hasidim, which is a medieval work, is one of his specialties. And a very eloquent man. I've heard him speak at conferences and so on. And his article was all about the fact that the reason that the Orthodox community is becoming more and more rigid and more rule-bound is because in Europe, where it was less so, there were organic communities, and you learned from people. And people are more flexible than books. So he said you would go to the rabbi for a ruling, and the rabbi knew the community, and he knew the people, and so on, so he could be more flexible because he knew that this woman, if he doesn't declare this chicken kosher, this woman's going to starve. So he found a way somehow, and people learned, because it was an organic community, to be flexible. But now, once the communities were destroyed, the learning was reconstituted from books and not from people. And books aren't flexible the way people are. And as a result, he said, the community that he now lives in is much less flexible and less willing to be flexible. Because the other reason they're less willing to be flexible is, if you get a teaching from your father, then you trust it. So you know your father was flexible about something, even if it contradicts the book. You're allowed to say, but this is the teaching I got from my father, so it's okay. But if you don't have a teaching from your father, from your grandfather, if you didn't grow up in a rabbinic court and so on and so forth, then you can't do that. So it's like, did you ever read In My Father's Court, Isaac Basheva Singer's memoir? It's wonderful, wonderful memoir about what it's like to grow up in a rabbinic court. And it's full of Singer's humor and so on. And you see, like, the way life was actually lived in these rabbinic courts is very different from the inflexibility of something that comes only out of a book. So, yeah.
It's kind of like the paradox of a book like the Torah is that you have the line, you have the laws about incest, you have the strict laws of who you marry and
yes.
This sort of thing, and at the same time, and things that show you should marry within the tribe.
Right.
And then you have the contradiction that the Messiah comes from incest and...
Right. And that's why, I completely agree with you, but that's why you see that if you look at traditional commentaries like the Stone, they try to force the stories into the paradigm of the law. Because that contradiction, which is pleasing to you, is troublesome to them. So, yeah.
Is this the first time that God is actually so direct in punishing somebody who does something wrong? Because I don't recall this, and
that's why.
It feels like the brothers have shifted away from fear of God, and they did all this, and God is saying, listen, I can actually punish people just like that, and it's a very...
That may be, God doesn't kill Cain, for example, and doesn't kill Adam. He does Lot's wife, and I was going to say the whole city of Sodom. So, there's a lot of, there are places before this where God does kill people, but it's been a few chapters, and maybe they need a little reminder.
A man
Only the first. Only the first. Right, only the first. Yeah, after that it's a, sure. It's a great, I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. I can give you a thought. The question was, why did they write these stories down if they contradicted the law? So I'll give you, thoughts on it. I don't know. One is that in all seriousness, there's tremendous enduring power to a good story. And a story that is provocative and makes people think and so on just, and gets changed, by the way, if you go and you think that story about what my father said to me was a good story, and you go and tell it, you'll tell it differently. And the person, it's like whisper down the lane or telephone, the person after that will tell it differently, and after that will tell it differently. And in some ways, by the way, it may get better. It's not that stories deteriorate necessarily, right? It might get to be a better story. And my guess is that these stories changed, got refined, got more interesting, more provocative in the retelling. But also they were the stories about the founding members of the tribe, and everything they did that was remembered was worth recording because you could learn something from it, even though some of it was problematic. And I don't know, in almost all founding religious stories, if you look in the New Testament, in the Quran, there's always ambiguous human behavior. It's not just in the Bible. I mean, maybe the Bible has more of it, and the rabbis try to cleanse it sometimes more, sometimes less. But I think that that's, I would say that maybe an encouraging thing about human beings is they have a greater, that they have at least enough fidelity to truth that they don't want to completely whitewash. You know, there's both impulses in us. Some of us want to believe that George Washington never told a lie, but there's also a part of us that wants to actually know what George Washington was like. So, one sec, let me just take people who haven't asked a question yet. Yeah, okay.
It's interesting that our current preference to written law is to prevent arbitrary, capricious, and unfair.
Right, it's true. I think, and maybe that's the difference between state law and religious law, is that religious law, since it governs all of life, has to make a lot more room for whim and caprice and so on, whereas governmental law really only regulates certain parts of life, and all the whim capricious stuff, like what you eat, how you eat, who you eat with, how you dress in the morning, all of that stuff, it doesn't regulate, so it's okay. But my guess is that the more detailed the law is, the more it has to leave room so that you can still function as a human being. Yeah?
Would Onan have received the birthright? He would have received the first inheritance from his father if he didn't have a son? Was that his motive for spilling his seed?
It could be that his motive was, if he doesn't have a son, then he gets it because there's no one else to give it to, since heir doesn't have anybody in his name. Right. So it could also be an economic motive. Right. Could also be an economic motive. Right. Yeah. Yes.
You said this story of when of that today people don't have that community that they're
right.
Dealing with the Torah with. So if in a certain sense, like looking at what's happening with Orthodox. And like when people come here, even people who are Orthodox here are really different than people who are Orthodox there in these little communities now. Mm-hmm. And you look at it and it's really crystallized. And it seems like one of the most fraught elements of Israel is this tension between the radically Orthodox, which is becoming mm-hmm. crystallized. And in a funny sense, it seems like they're making, it's like the Torah is known as a living truth, or the living Torah, we talk about the tree of life for those who go to it. But it seems like what they're doing is making an idol out of it.
I'll say this. I don't actually want to. I mean, you may or may not be right, but I don't actually want to make this into a critique of one or another parts of Judaism. I just wanted to talk about Soloveitchik's article, but I will say this about the issue of orthodoxy in the Jewish world. There has been a tremendous increase in orthodoxy in the Jewish world, and it's completely unsurprising. And I know exactly why it is, and if you think about it for a second, you'll realize why it is. I don't mean any particular motivation, but Jews do what everyone else does. And a wave of religiosity, of fundamentalism, has swept the Islamic world and the Christian world. It would be shocking if it didn't sweep the Jewish world too. I mean, would we be the only ones who don't have whatever it is that is creating this wave of fundamentalist religion through the world? And we could argue all day about what factors or technology or modernity or whatever. But whatever it is, the same thing affects Jews too. So it's not as though we have to look inside Judaism for some misinterpretation that says, why is it that all of a sudden there's this tremendous upswing in Jewish fundamentalism? If, trust me, if there is a waning of fundamentalism in Islam and in Christianity, there'll be a waning in Judaism too, right? We're not that separate, guys. I mean, that's the truth. And so we're just part of a worldwide trend. I don't know what will happen with that worldwide trend, but we're a piece of it. So for better or for worse, however you feel about it, we're a piece of it. Yeah.
You suppose the writing began to the rabbis, and the rabbis were at the beginning of the diaspora. Didn't they feel, since they no longer had the temple, they had to create some kind of a blueprint that people could follow as they went
yes.
to different places?
Well, the
oral tradition alone would not have been as binded or as unified.
Well, the oral tradition was actually what the rabbis promoted, and for a long time, in the rabbis, remember there are two destructions. Okay, so this is a nice, actually not nice, but it's a good thing to close on. The destruction, let's talk. So here's the way that most scholars see it, combine traditional and modern scholarship. The first destruction of the temple, according to some people, was the beginning of the combining and writing down of the Torah, because it was clear how many traditions were going to get lost, right? So once the Northern Kingdom was destroyed and then the Southern Kingdom, I won't go through the history at the moment, but that's when it... Then the rabbis had an oral tradition about the Torah, right? There's the written law and the oral law. It's still called the oral law. A Torah Shabal Peh, the oral law. The oral law is the Talmud. For a long time, you weren't supposed to write it down. The first code that was actually written and codified was the Mishnah, and that was done around 200 CE. That means for hundreds of years, the rabbis were discussing the law without anybody producing a book. Now, they had their own notes, we know, from the academy, from their lectures and so on, and different people had different Mishnahs that they used. Rabbi Akiva had his own private Mishnah that he would use to teach, and others had theirs, but nobody wrote it down, and the reason they didn't write it down was for all the reasons we said. That if it was just us in this room, right, or just us and the kids in the school, you wouldn't actually have to write down the law, right? We would all know what each other, and there would be like, I don't know, this section of the room would be the senior rabbinic court, and we would all live more or less by what they said, and if there was a dispute, we'd come in front of them, and they would make a decision, and you wouldn't have to write it down. Now, all of a sudden, comes the second great tragedy, which is the destruction of the Second Temple, right? The Bar Kokhba revolt and all of that. And now people realize that it's going to be lost forever. And that's when you get the Mishnah written down. The Bar Kokhba revolt is 135, right? The Hadrianic persecutions finish in 135, and by 200, that is 65 years later, you have the Mishnah. So it's clear, and the Mishnah, by the way, was finished by Rabbi Judah the Prince, who was not only a scholar, but also a communal leader. So he had enough authority to say, this is the book. But it took a lot for the oral tradition to get written down, because it was very hard for people to give up the idea that it was in exchange and in discussion and so on, that you would, remember, writing was rare and hard for thousands of years. So it was a huge change. Writing today is so easy and facile, and we write everything down. But the whole idea that you would write down the spoken word of God transmitted from the spoken word of your rabbi was very foreign to most Jews for most of history. Okay, with that, let's do the Kaddish Rabbanan. And next week, don't forget Leon Wieseltier. Bring your friends. You won't regret it.